Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be interviewing Michael Gilson about his book titled Behind the Privet Hedge, Richard Sudell, The Suburban Garden and the Beautification of Britain, out in 2024 from Reaction, which is, I found, a really helpful book, to be honest, because living in the UK, we see roses, privet hedges, little gardens outside the houses in front of really many houses, all houses, I admit my own included. But how did we actually get to this point where this was really such an obsession that's just, it's seemingly baked into the culture of the country? I'm always curious about things like that. And it turns out there's a story behind it, a very interesting story that is not what I expected. And I think other listeners and readers of the book will have a similar experience. So Michael, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast to reveal this history to us.
Thanks for having me, Miranda.
To start us off, could you please introduce yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Yeah, it's well, first and foremost, I should say I'm a journalist by trade and a newspaper editor. I've been in that business for many, many years now, more years than I care to remember. But a few years back, I wanted to do something completely different and challenge myself outside comfort zone. And so I took a master's at the Institute of Historical Research in London in garden landscape history, and I was fascinated. It was tough. But I guess, like everybody, when I thought about landscape and gardens, I thought about antiquity and Renaissance gardens and Baroque gardens and all those grandiose things that we saw. And I got sort of sidetracked into suburban gardens, and I found a very interesting anthracite, seam of anthracite for study, really. And I think going back on it, it was probably my grandfather was a very, I don't think he'd mind me saying this, a minor municipal landscape gardener, and had a superb suburban garden, which was full of shade and colour and a little bit of fruit and vegetables at the back. And it was always a fascinating place for me and my brother. So, you know, full of immaculate exactitude. And I think maybe he was sort of reaching out to me to turn me away from the Baroque and into the suburban.
What an interesting way to get into a project. Thank you for giving us that bit of backstory. I know it sounds obvious to ask about chapter one. That is kind of obviously the beginning of the book. But yeah, that isn't necessarily always what grabs me when reading a book and not always the thing that I ask about first. But in this case, I really couldn't resist. Can you take us to chapter one of the book? Why do you start with the 1924 Roehampton Estates Tenants Association meeting?
Yeah, when you talk like that, Mariah, it doesn't sound very promising, does it? But to be honest, but yeah, I think, you know, my view on history is it has to be about people. I mean, that sounds pretty obvious, but I think this story about the explosion of suburban gardens is a people history. It's about the people who, there were obviously people and theorists and architects and all the rest of it, but fundamentally, this was a thirst in the interwar years and after the Second World War in Britain, of people to change their lives and their environments. And so we do go in 1924, as you say, to the Roehampton Estate Tenants Association meeting on Roehampton, which just for your listeners is West London, now called the Dover House Estate. And it was one of the London County Council estates, garden suburb estates, that was built after the First World War under what is loosely can be termed as the Home Sit for Heroes building plan, which was, you know, two issues behind that. One was that many working class men coming back from the First World War were determined they would not go back or did not want to go back to the inner city areas and the deprivation they had experienced after fighting the war. And the second thing was the government, with its looking over its shoulder at the Bolshevik Revolution, was very concerned that if this was the case, First World War brought an incredible demand for change. And so the houses would be almost an emollient to kind of, you know, mitigate or stop any similar thing that was going on in Russia at the time. And for me, that was, you know, that's an interesting debate in itself. But obviously what came with these houses, 5 million houses, both private and public, built in the interwar years to create this new environment for many, many inner city slum dwellers, was that they also came with 400 square foot of garden, as it was written down. Now, the house was complete. That's fine. They'd move into these houses, which were dreams for them. The garden was just a bit of claggy clay, particularly in London, was clay. So suddenly, millions of people were confronted with something they'd never had before, open space, and didn't know what to do with it, frankly. And so we go to the Roehampton, I'm going to get to your question in a minute. We go to the Roehampton Estates Tenants Association, because in that meeting, Richard Sudell, the hero of the book, is giving, it's a classic meeting, those new estates and those new communities growing up, suddenly they were really interested in issues of boiler maintenance and all this kind of minutiae of new daily life on these estates. And we go into that meeting because Richard Sudell is giving them, who founded the Roehampton Garden Society on that estate within those years. We go into that meeting because if you'd have been passing that meeting hall, you would have suddenly heard a huge applause from the people in that meeting listening to, about their new community. And that was because Sudell was telling them about the progress they had made with their gardens in just two short years. And to me, this was all in minutes that I'd discovered and in community newsletters. And to me, it was about, you know, that what it brought home was that incredible enthusiasm. You know, imagine in a community hall where the Garden Society chairman is getting a standing ovation for driving and fundamentally creating a powerful gardening force, the like of which was being repeated all over the country, I should add. But to me, it really did take you into the fact that this was a movement and the enthusiasm of it. And I just, you know, I think history's got to take you there. You've got to be able to smell the grass and scent of the flowers. And I think that is what I tried to do in that meeting.
It's definitely a way into kind of the many debates that are going on at this point. So I'm glad you covered them a bit in that answer. I think we don't think so much about kind of what happened after the end of World War One and what impact that had on people's lives, but that's incredibly important context for all of this. So very useful way to start off the book and obviously start off our discussion. But I think we need to do a bit of introducing of this key person. So who was Richard Sudell? What were his early years like? And what was he up to in World War One that was so impactful for what he did afterwards?
Yes. Let's go back a bit. You're right. I think he's the forgotten man, and I'm hopefully going to change that, of this period in British landscape history. He was brought up in a poor household in nearby Preston in Lancashire, in the north of England. He left school at 14 and became an apprentice gardener, as many did there in some of the estates, and worked as an apprentice gardener for many years. His father was a hay dealer, very affected by agricultural depressions at the time. So they certainly knew poverty. And they were also, I think it's very important to point out, they were from a Quaker background. So, you know, perhaps we can talk about a little bit about how, you know, Quaker values and politics combined in this era. But fundamentally, he combined, I think, faith and certainly the politics of socialism at that time to that sort of formed his life as he was working in these gardens in Lancashire. What happened was he got to Kew, which was a pretty incredible thing even then to do. He got to Kew as a trainee gardener just before the outbreak of war. But of course, when military conscription was brought in, Richard Soudal is a Quaker, was determined that he was not going to serve in the First World War. He was a conscientious objector. Quakers had been debating this in the lead up to the war about what they would do. Many of them wanted to be martyrs for the causes. The laws gave them opt-out. You could have had a conscientious opt-out from military service if you were to say, I'm a Quaker or I don't believe in religion. But Soudal and many other Quakers refused to take this option and were thus absolutist, what we call absolutist conscientious objectors. Only about 1,300 of these people were consistently and constantly jailed throughout the First World War. Solitary confinement, sewing mail bags, literally sewing mail bags. We always think of that as a stereotype, don't we? No mattresses and sometimes, you know, solitary confinement for up to 7 days. And Soudal, at a very young age, in his early 20s, was jailed 3 times during the First World War. And I think during that period as well, at some points in furlough in his time there, he became involved in an organization called the Vacant Land Cultivation Society, set up by an American philanthropist, Joseph Fells. And what that did really was, as the First World War got on, it took particularly in London, vacant land, as it says in the title, and started to use this land for food, because obviously food was scarce, hunger was widespread. And Soudal, using both his politics and his horticultural expertise, you see the start of a merging of these kind of two things. And he worked very strongly with the Vacant Land Cultivation Society, taking over land, telling people that it was nonsense that you couldn't use this land for food, because sometimes owners didn't want to get rid of it if it was development land that obviously wasn't going to be developed in the First World War. And so, you know, the First World War and the conscientious objecting and working with the Vacant Land Cultivation Society really did forge him as a very young man. I mean, he's only in his early 20s at that time. Being jailed for a conscientious objector was obviously a terrifying prospect. It was brutal. The beatings being dished out in prisons have been well recorded, the prime source of this story. But yes, I mean, that's really where he came out of the First World War, kind of forged in that, knowing that a career in places like Kew was over, because conscientious objectors largely kept quiet, and I believe that Soudal really didn't tell as many people about this as possible. A new start came, and he came and found himself on Roehampton, maybe ironically on Homes Fit for Heroes, but started to think about landscape and politics as one thing. So I think that was really obviously formative years for him.
I want to talk about this link then between gardening and politics before we get into kind of some more of the specifics about the gardening. Why did he link those things? What political work did he think that gardens could do?
There was no distinction I think what's really important, there was no distinction in those days between, you know, advances in what a lot of radicals and nonconformists like Quakers and people thought, that the environment was as important as even economic changes. And as we know, there was a massive swirl of politics and theory and environment and land and all in the debates. And these debates, unlike today, some of these were prime time debates. You know, this was really important. What would a new Britain look like after the war to end all wars? I think that at that stage, what he thought and what many people thought was beautification, gardening, flowers, were as important to new living conditions as anything else. There was no real hierarchy here. There were, for example, I mean, there were an absolutely incredible Quaker couple called Alfred and Ada Salter, who basically were politicians in Bermondsey, who had a beautification committee at Bermondsey Council. Bermondsey was an incredibly deprived area in that time. And beautification was a committee on Bermondsey Council that was important as any other committee in that council. That window boxes in slum houses, that trees in an alleyway, that churchyards cleared so that children could play in those areas. Those were absolutely as important about lifting all of these people out of poverty and giving them as much access to open space as they could. It was a very political, activity.
Hmm. Okay, that's very helpful to understand, particularly given that it's not just him. As you said, there is this community around it. What then do these gardens look like? Can you give us an example of sort of the things he might have been talking about if we think about that Roehampton meeting? What was Sudell's idea of kind of a house's garden meant to be?
Yeah, I think, yes, it's important because, these gardens then did become subject of ridicule later on. Perhaps we'll get to that. But first and foremost, they were labour saving. So Sudell knew that the point of bringing all of these thousands and thousands of new gardeners along was you could not discourage them. Like I say, if you take yourself back to that 400 square foot of clay, this was like climbing or, painting the Sistine Chapel with a roller painter. You know, it was very tough for these people. So the gardens had to be labor saving. They had to be simple, straight lined affairs, but also giving privacy, because this is another interesting thing. So what you saw there was obviously the privet hedge, which is obviously the title of the book. There's a clue there. And of course, that gave it gave privacy. But it also was a very robust growing hedge that could give privacy, as I said, and could protect other flowers. The front garden was of these houses was pretty much small, but what it had to do was contribute to the beauty of the community. That was very, very clear from people like Sudell and even housing inspectors who used to come around to these estates at the time. So they would be, you might have pyracantha in the doorway, you might have hanging baskets, you'd have a little bit of lawn where there'd be borders of pansies. There'd be the standard tea rose. These were started to be bred in those times for these gardens. Roses obviously were very much part of the suburban garden. If you were adventurous, you might cut a little hole in the front of those that turf in which you could put snapdragons, pansies, and other site plants in there as well. So that circular little bed within lawns becomes quite ubiquitous. Back gardens, as we talked about there, should be planned and properly, but they were always straight. I call Sudell the patron saint of crazy paving. Crazy paving, again, became one of those things that was ridiculed. But actually what crazy paving did was give you straight lines, pathways north to south if you could. But maybe growing a little bit of time between them. So as you could crush it underfoot and scents would come up. Lawns, again, beds, sort of circular beds for roses were very important. Sometimes borders, if people were feeling, he was always encouraging people. If you wanted to feel a little bit more adventurous, there were borders that you could build. And then at the back, really crucially, a little bit of dividing line, probably with a morello cherry trees or something like that. But at the back, always, and particularly bear in mind the times that we're living in this period, space for vegetables and fruit, because growing of that, as he found with the Vacant Land Cultivation Society, growing your own food for him was just an amazing two things. Obviously, incredibly practical, healthy, and also getting back that link to nature. And so there was always, and my grandfather's one exactly that, and you probably know them too, always a space at the back for the growing of shallots and whatever. Start off with potatoes, because they were easy, but then you could move in. And that's what Sudell always did. Well, let's move into the Webb's carrot, start with your potatoes. If you see a potato coming, you're delighted, I've grown a potato. And the next thing you can do is go on from there. And they became... And these gardens as well, because don't forget, it wasn't just the council estates. And we're talking about metro land here, where the speculative building of private estates, they've kind of followed this similar pattern. On the front was the kind of let's beautify our community. on the back was there was your privacy. That's your open space. There would always be a shady seat where you could sit and enjoy, because for Sudell, what was really important, these were one day a week working gardens, because you were really busy trying to pay rents and the rest of it. And you should also rest in it and let, and as importantly, let children play in it. So, you know, that was the kind of standard. But he also encouraged, if you wanted to have a little experiment, don't worry about getting it wrong. Just try.
This, I think, is where it starts to sound very familiar to anyone who lives in the UK, because that is, in a lot of ways, exactly what we still have now.
Yeah.
But as you mentioned earlier, not everyone was on board with these ideas. So can you maybe talk us through a bit the opposition to this, especially the idea that this is sort of all, well, it's a bit kitschy, it's a bit in poor taste.
Yes.
How, when, and why did those ideas develop?
Pretty soon afterwards, I think they, you know, these gardens became twee, and you saw the rise of the garden gnome, for example, and that sort of thing, which, you know, just on the garden gnome, for example, 50 years before that, they were brought into a country house as garden sprites in Northamptonshire, and they were seen as incredible. Wow, these are garden sprites from the Black Country in Germany. 50 years later, put into suburbia, they took on a different meaning. And I think there's a very interesting class connotations about that going on. But you're right, yes. I mean, I suppose it came out of a really big debate about what would post-war Britain like. Was it a chance to modernize, and modernize in the truest sense of that, in terms of the modern movement and things like that, to build new, brave communities, or, you know, and to preserve rural little and then build modernistic, beautiful towns that people would love to live in. Instead, what they got was the sprawl of suburbia reaching out into countryside. And there are clear class connotations of this, because for the first time, what was happening in these suburbs were working class people were moving in to this green and pleasant land. And so there was a sort of combination of, you know, a combination of what might be called preservationists and modernists who were looking to develop a new virile Britain. And what they saw instead was these people hiding behind their privet hedges, as suburbia spread out into what they thought was rural idyll. Now, it's worth bearing in mind that this rural idyll was off bounds, as it is today, to many, many people of these working class, and they had their own rural. There was no, the critics didn't see the gardens as rurality, whereas many of the residents did. But this came pretty quickly, this debate. And it didn't just include architects and people like that. It was a cultural debate too. It was prime time on the BBC. John Betjeman and George Orwell and all these great people just started to talk about what the suburbs were like. The people missing from that debate, you will not be surprised to know, were the people living there themselves who'd been taken out of slums. And the whole idea about this privacy thing as well, which is worth pointing out, is that if you'd lived in, I don't know, let's say the East End of London, and you know, you didn't have any privacy anyway. There were, even up to the First World War and beyond, there were communal toilets and things like that, and absolutely profound deprivation. You know, to get a bit of privacy in your own garden was an astonishing development in your life. But for some, and I say again, these people were not people who lived in these places, it was a missed opportunity. People had fought in the First World War to come back to a new virile Britain, instead of which was they got people sort of cutting holes in lawns to put standard tea roses in.
Hmm. Again, so many things that sound familiar today on multiple levels about this. So really interesting to understand the origins of many of these debates. Obviously, this, I suppose, sneering about these gardens, as much as it is a debate that we still have, obviously part of the reason it's still a debate is that Sudell's vision of these gardens works, right? If people weren't actually doing this, then there wouldn't be anything to debate about. So let's talk a bit about, I suppose, how his ideas became so well known. Obviously, he can't go to every tenants association meeting.
No.
So can you talk a bit about his writing career and why you think he was so popular, how he stood out perhaps amongst others who were writing about gardening advice at the time?
Yeah, I think there's a really, I quite like this example, which is kind of like a War of the Roses sort of thing, which I maybe may illustrate something. There were all kinds of roses in those times, obviously, and you had those of you listeners who know a little bit about garden history will know before, you know, in that run-up, there was the country house planting schemes of people like Gertrude Jekyll and William Robinson, which was kind of like taking the manor house and building on it. So you had massive displays of herbaceous borders and things like that, and lots of wild flowers. Now, bear in mind, Gertrude Jekyll, whose, you know, arts and crafts gardens are still admired today, had 11 full-time gardeners to keep her garden looking nice and naturalistic. But if you look at roses, Soudel knew that the tea rose was, you know, these new hybrid tea roses were the sorts of things that would bring lovely colour into these new estates. And there was a real sort of, if you think about, so for example, there was a brilliant hybrid at that time called the Betty Up Richard, which is a name that is so redolent of the suburban estate. It was nice and big and bold. And more importantly, what it did, and what other people didn't realise, was it stood up to the pollution that was found in most inner city areas. But reigned against Betty Up Richard were things like the Madame Louis Levesque, the French rose of the century before, which was wilder and smaller, less blousy, if you like. But it had, you know, for Soudel, Sue knew when he's planting that would have much more difficulty in thriving in these areas. But the rose became political in its meaning there. And that's why Soudel understood all these things, because he was practical. The word practical leapt off the pages everywhere. And so he started writing on Roehampton for the Roehampton Gazette, which was an astonishing sort of journal. Well, it was a parish pump magazine for the state. And it quickly showed how community-minded all these people got in this new, their new green and pleasant land. And he wrote very, very simple practical advice, simple, encouraging. But at the time, there was a huge explosion, there was a huge explosion because people started to see this, newspapers and things like that started to think there's an audience here, there's a new audience of suburban gardeners that we can use. But the problem was that many, many, many of these magazines and books and things like that tried to encourage the suburban gardener to plant manor house, country house planting schemes. There were pictures and all these things, you know, Garden Illustrated and things like that, of these fantastical gardens. And some suburban gardeners did try to copy these things and put them in. And you see images of these festooned, chaotic gardens with things growing everywhere, these very tiny gardens, as people tried garden and one-upmanship and to move into what they thought was acceptable, you know, what was acceptable aspirational middle-class gardening. And what happened with that is they got ridiculed for the very thing they were trying to do by the very people they wanted to be in, you know, with, which was the middle classes and the garden writers and etc. Soudel was different. What he came was a very formal garden, a very simple garden, but still beautiful, tree-lined, giving privacy, but as I say, very simple, hardy plants that would grow in straight lines. And I think that was the big difference from him. He wrote beautifully, practically. The other thing about these books that he started writing, he wrote 47 books at the end of the First World War and into beyond the Second World War. 47. That's just one author, which gives you an idea of the thirst for information that these people wanted. He wrote for Ideal Home magazine from the very first edition. Ideal Home was a curious magazine which was set up at the time to appeal to the new suburbanites. It was very aspirational in terms of the houses. You saw those Tudor-Bethan houses of Metroland in there, many of which would have been out of the range of the readers, but who liked, just like we do today, I guess, gaze at richer people's houses. But the gardens garden advice themselves in Ideal Homes, written by Soudel, was very much a garden of its time, delineated spaces, colours, primary colours, bringing colour to war-weary grey Britain, you know, stretching out out from the cities. It's worth just remembering, because I shouldn't let this go, that when the critics talked about this spread of suburbia and, you know, encroaching on rurality and destroying, you know, this Albion, if you like, there were 500,000 acres of gardens developed between the First and the Second World War. That is an astonishing growth of a new rurality, if you like. But yeah, back to your question. Soudell wrote for Idle Home. He then wrote for the Daily Herald, which was set up as a paper of the working class and was the biggest newspaper in the world. So in a very short period of time, this guy who left school at 14 went from sort of writing to, I don't know, 2,000 people on Roehampton to writing to about 3 million people a week with his gardening advice on all these platforms. And it's not too far-fetched, I don't think. Well, no, it isn't too far-fetched. I think he was the most well-read garden journalist at the time. And I think Soudell Gardens, you know, cropped up everywhere. And many of them are still with us today, all but with me one or two modern touches, maybe.
Hmm. Very interesting to understand. And I think that is so key of not just there is an audience, but the audience wants certain things and is more able to do certain things. And that kind of speaks a lot to what then becomes popular. Can we talk a bit about, I suppose, how these ideas develop, not just kind of between now and then, but even over the course of Soudell's own career? You talk later in the book about his thinking on, for example, bigger gardens, on architecture. Things expand from just a small house and what you might have available in front or behind it. Can you talk about this expansion of his ideas and work?
Yeah, I think he does. Yes, I think, you know, obviously once he'd got success there in that area, and perhaps we'll come on to talk about his work with professionalized landscape architecture. But yeah, I mean, obviously, as a, you know, this was a guy who trained at Kew, and when he was earlier days, he'd worked with orchids. So his choice originally about this suburban garden, much criticized by people, was a choice. It wasn't because of a lack of knowledge on his part. So obviously he always had that ability as he moved forward to start thinking. So he could take us out of the garden gate, if you like, and into a wider world. And it's worth pointing out at this time that he was an incredible evangelist for gardens, and started to, you know, mobilize people across, and particularly starting off in London with something which is really important, again, lost to social history of this time, called the London Gardens Guild. And he was the secretary and organizing person of that. And it turned later into the National Gardens Guild. And the whole point of that was to lift people and encourage people to garden, communal lawnmowers, seeds at half price. And the really interesting thing here is competition, because this is the start of garden competitions. All the things that were, you know, good fertilizer for comic humor about biggest marrow and all the rest of it. This was where it started. And in London, the London Gardens Championships, which was all about London garden guilds on estates and working, mainly working class gardens, but also the, you know, the Metroland estates, thousands and thousands. By the end of the First World War, Soudell had managed to get 50,000 people entering the London Gardens Championships, which were held. The winners had their gardens in miniature, developed at the London Gardens Championship every year. 15,000 people queuing to get in to see these things. Across town, the Chelsea Flower Show didn't get anywhere near as many as an audience as this. The London Gardens Championship is forgotten, and of course, but that's that kind of evolving of that kind of movement. We will turn London into a city of gardens, is what Soudell and others said, and that's what they really meant, and that's what they really tried to do. So yes, but obviously, as his practice developed, he did start to, you know, he was a landscape gardener himself, so he did start to design bigger places and bigger gardens, and they did develop, and you know, there were things like, in some books that he was writing about, there were even plans for tennis courts and things like that. These tennis courts are not quite what we would think now when we look at Wimbledon, but nevertheless, there was these bigger gardens that he catered for as his own business grew, you know. But he never lost sight, I think it's really important to say, he never really lost sight, when he went to the National Gardens Guilds, the president, the Prisoners Gardens Association, the Allotment Association of that, all of these really important things he kept placing, the National Playing Fields Associations as well, because these were other movements about open space being good for exercise, and, you know, people living in cramped spaces needed them. So it went from inside the suburban garden to a much more national. So on the one hand, he built bigger gardens and bigger works for cemeteries and things like this. But on the other hand, he spread the word as well with others to make sure that this wasn't just happening in Roehampton, it was happening everywhere.
Hmm. I'd like to ask about one of the ways that he's working with others to, especially on this kind of landscape architecture side, because as much as I think we could say the whole book is sort of forgotten history, this aspect of it seems more forgotten, if that's even possible. You talk about his work as a landscape architect, but also his work in professionalizing the whole idea of landscape architects and that being a thing that is kind of a proper job that's organized in a professionalized way. Can you talk a bit about the role he had in these processes and why this might be the most forgotten bit of his career?
Yeah, you're right. It is interesting because obviously, again, in this swirl of politics and history and land, people started to think about the debate about reimagining a new country that arose from, well, both wars, really. And Soudel was the founder of something that's now called the Landscape Institute and used to be called the Institute of Landscape Architects. And what it was about was to try and make sure that land and landscape had equal billing with architecture so that when this new reimagined Britain was coming along, it was working in tandem. And Soudel, for all of his, you know, working class roots and all that, recognized when he saw he was a member of Kew and the RHS and things like that, and saw in Europe a growing kind of purpose about landscape architecture. And he thought that Britain was going to be left behind. And he got together with two or three others. And he was the first person to ask for landscape gardeners, as they were at the time, to come to a meeting to start talking about how we could push, well, they could, sorry, push this case for new definitions of land. He was just a gardener. He was a very working class gardener. But anyway, they came to his office in Gower Street, which was the home of the London Gardens Guild, Geoffrey Jellicoe, and all these very big names, Brenda Colvin, and names that would go on to be much, much bigger than him. And it's quite interesting because in that meeting, the first one, in his own offices, a sort of fairly minor but upper class landscaper called Gilbert Jenkins whispered in Geoffrey Jellicoe's ear, "We have to get Soudel out of the chair and Thomas Mawson in." Thomas Mawson was a big figure in landscape and architecture who'd done lots of work. You know, critics vary about how good it was, but nevertheless, he was a name, with Lutyens and people like that at the time. And Soudel simply wasn't. He was seen as a suburban garden person. But nevertheless, he had the vision, as Jellicoe said. Soudel had done a great job to get this thing off the ground, but we needed more heft, if you like. And I think Soudel's, you know, this was hugely class-driven societies and Lancashire accent, working class. Not known whether people knew he was a conscientious objector or not, but nevertheless, his face, even though he'd set this thing up, his face didn't fit. It wasn't until 1955 that he was made president of the ILA, but fundamentally, he still kept in there saying, we need to keep pushing the case for landscape. Everything open to the sky needs to be developed. People were talking about national planning policy, not a free market free-for-all in those days. And these were huge, huge debates that took in everybody, politicians, the rest of it. And Soudel, having set the ILA up, was in the background pushing for these things. And as I say, not present, but it was really fascinating time. Landscape architects trying to get a seat at the top table. One thing that did happen was that once the ILA was set up, and Soudel knew this was going to happen, it was that many bodies like councils and things like that charged with rebuilding or reimagining their areas did come to the ILA for agreed landscape architects to do things like cemeteries and all the rest of it. And Soudel did a lot of cemeteries because it was really important that the mundane was beautified. You know, I mean, Soudel used to landscape around gas holders for the North Essex Gas Company. And they didn't see this as something, you know, to be poo-pooed at, although Soudel did a lot of this work when people like Jellicoe and those did very grandiose projects. But that was the landscape debate at the time, and Soudel's role in it has been, you only have to go to the ILA's archives and their history books to see that Soudel doesn't really appear in these things in place of names. And I think it was that he was associated with the suburban garden for us. And that didn't quite fit into the, you know, to the kind of debate that the ILA wanted. Now, Sudell was entirely capable of having that debate and did so. I mean, but I think that's why his role as the founder of this body, which still exists and still has landscape architects as members, has largely been airbrushed.
Forgotten history within the forgotten history. How interesting.
Yes.
I want to stay on this idea of kind of his philosophy about what should be done about open spaces. You talk about in the book that the courtyard garden at Dolphin Square might be, quote, a perfect summation of his philosophy. Can you tell us about this particular bit of his work and why it might be such a good example?
Yeah, I think the first thing to say is there's very little record left of Sudell. And again, this goes back to the question we were talking about first. There's very little left of a record. I mean, his family, who were wonderfully helpful in my research into this book, really didn't know how important he was a figure. And none of his work and the records of his work have survived. And if you go to the landscape architect, I think, in Reading University, the Museum of English Rural Life now, Sudell's file isn't very tiny compared to some of the bigger names that I've just mentioned. So we don't really know what we do know that he did a lot of cemeteries. And out of nowhere, the biggest garden landscape contract he ever won was at Dolphin Square in Pimlico on the banks of the Thames, Grosvenor Roads there. And that was the first ever concierge. It was the biggest block of flats. Some of your listeners may know it now. And Sudell was commissioned by Fred Costain, the builder, to create the courtyard garden. If you can imagine this building, all around, it's a square building of 10-story high flats. And the good thing for Sudell and what Sudell liked about it was they were for relatively cheap rent for people who actually, and here's an echo of today, actually people who needed to work, you know, the clerical classes and whatever in inner London and couldn't afford, you know, so nothing ever changes in some ways. Anyway, Sudell designed this is the garden, his biggest ever work, and it's still there in some form. And it's almost as if it's worth a visit, because it's almost as if he'd taken a kind of tapestry of suburban gardens and sewn them together. That's what you see in here. There's what he always said. There's solitude. There's sanctuary. There's you know, he kept saying people, you know, what everybody wants and what everyone should give, not just the privileged, is a relief from the turmoil of the day, as he constantly saw it. And when you go to Dolphin Square Court Garden, you get that. I mean, you're right in the middle of London. But it's a patchwork of beautiful gardens all set out. Bear in mind, there's hardly any sunlight in this place because it's surrounded by these things. But it's, you know, there are straight lines again, crazy paving, guess what? Yews, hedges, roses, tulips, hollyhocks, petunias, all those things, those flowers, you know, heaven forbid dahlias, which were loathed by the country house set, are there. And it's a beautiful garden, but it is very much the different. And what he said about suburban gardens as well, little sight lines from windows that you could see even to a, you know, and this is where he really fell out with some of the more progressive, if you like, gardeners, you know, statutory, a little leaden lad, he would say, in some ways could be a sight line. You know, you can see some landscape architects and architects having the vapors when he used to write that sort of stuff. And that's what you see in Dolphin, suddenly transported, put together, almost like he's done a museum of his work. And it's worth just pointing out that garden was under a huge amount of threat a few years back by people who bought the thing and wanted to expand the number of flats and things like that. And for the first time, a combination of people, including the 20th Century Society and campaigners and residents, got together to try and save that garden. And it was registered by Historic England a few years back. And it, for the first time ever, it, you know, I suppose it officially, he was recognized, this garden is worth preserving because he is an early 20th century garden pioneer. And that was the first time. And thankfully, it was saved. And a new landscape architect, is trying to bring Sudell's stuff back together again. That access to land for all. Sally Prothero is working on that project now. But it is really a quite remarkable and the really one surviving. There is just one other, if you don't mind me saying, in the City of London cemetery in Manor Park in East London, huge Victorian ostentatious cemetery. Plonked in the middle of that in 1950 was a memorial garden for the cremation areas, which is absolutely a suburban garden. It's set in the middle of all these great and the good burial places. And that is Sudell stamping his mark. Also, what he said about cemeteries were, they shouldn't just be for the dead. Let's get people from the inner city to come and play and enjoy them rather than just have them as places of memorials. So that's why I say it's a perfect summation of the philosophy. I hope that's answered the question.
Yeah, it absolutely has. And I think probably a number of listeners will be going, hang on a second, I need to go check this out.
Well, hopefully. And also just take a look, because it's still, it looks like it's been saved, but it would be the last surviving example of his work. And, you know, we always save, in Britain, we're very used to save Victorians. There's Victorian and Georgian societies wanted saving this. But think people like the 20th Century Society, trying to save that 20th century history, to me, is as important.
Hmm. No, that's definitely a point worth making. I wonder if I can ask you sort of a big picture question as we come towards the end of our discussion. As I've mentioned a number of times, I learnt a lot from this book. There were a number of things in it that I was quite surprised by. What about you? Was there anything in the research or writing of this that really kind of jumped out and surprised you?
Well, I'm tempted to say everything, because it was, you know, without getting all Simon Cowell on you, it was an incredible journey for me on this thing. I mean, I first heard while doing my studies of a journalist who on this estate was organising people, and I didn't know anything else about him from that. I didn't know who he was, and certainly when you start to look, you find very little, and so. Kind of just like one of his gardens as you turn corners, everything was a little surprise, really. I think, you know, to me, the incredible thing is that these suburban gardens, well, it's just so ridiculed. And nobody, you know, if you say suburbia now, where do you live in suburbia? I live in suburbia in Britain. There's a value judgment put on you straight away, isn't there? You know, which is, dull conformity, middle class, curtain twitching, yada, yada. But what really surprised me was this social movement in that time, and why we need to understand this history of land in Britain, because it's not the stereotype that we hear of today. And by the way, the suburbs today are under real pressure as inner cities are revived. You know, the suburbs of people living, there's almost a reverse thing going on there. There was a report by the Smith Institute a few years back saying the suburbs are in crisis. These were the places where people went for sanctuary. Now they are in trouble themselves. But yeah, I mean, finding this fellow and really kind of understanding and celebrating his drive. I mean, he spent his whole life, died in 1968, arguing the same things, really, and putting it into practice. I always say he got his hands dirty for the cause, and he literally did. You know, he helped change Britain inch by hard dug inch, and that was exactly what was going on. That's what I found so fascinating. And I think you mentioned it a bit earlier there, Murat. The one thing I would say about him too as well is what I think is he's kind of like a confluence of that time. He's not the greatest landscape architect of all time in any way, shape or form. Jellicoe, Colvin, all those people did work much, much better. But he's a real interesting confluence between, you know, the suburban garden, it's all association of conservative connotations, and yet landscape architecture, which was about stretching the horizons of the possible. So you had these two things going on there that he kind of sat in the middle of, and I think that was really fascinating. And I do think, as you suggested, that his gardens have stood the test of time. You know, if you look at what people wanted instead, the modernists, they wanted huge tower blocks going into the sky. If you go to Roehampton, if you could just indulge me on this, you go to Roehampton, or now called the Dover House Estate, by the way, right next door to that, cheek by jowl, is something called the Alton Estate, which was a Le Corbusier-inspired slabs of concrete blocks going into the sky, salivated, did modern movement architects over this stuff. It is a disaster. It is a total disaster. It's a place where people don't like to live. It's the horror estate. There's a headline where some people think it's hell. Architects imposing ways of living on people. Just over the corner, there's Dover House, this arts and crafts garden suburb where people can't wait to get on there. There's a 4-year waiting list for the allotments. And the contrast in that geographic area, it could not be starker. between Alton, which now still gets, you still, if you Google that, you'll still see people saying what a fantastic piece of architecture that is. None of these architects, of course, lived there. But the fact is, it's a 5-minute walk to the other estate, which is where Sudell started his lifetime's work. One has been incredibly successful, one hasn't. But the one that hasn't was the one that got all the headlines back in the early 20th century.
Hmm. All the more reason to have a book like this then, to help us understand the people who got their hands dirty, right? And their actual experiences. So thank you for taking us through it. I do have one final question though, although we are, I suppose, done discussing this book. Now that it's out in the world, is there anything you might be working on next?
Yes, I think, I'm starting to work on a book about an alleged Nazi war criminal who moved to Britain after the end of the Second World War. And when I was a very callow journalist at the age of 21, I stumbled across this fellow and did a lot of work with him. And it was all about, it's a story about how Britain allowed high worth alleged Nazi war criminals into this country at that time. And it's, as you can probably tell, it's a complete antidote to the one I've been doing on the Suburban Garden. But that's what I'm looking at next, a slightly different topic.
Well, still sounds interesting, though. So perhaps you'll come back another time and tell us about it. But in the meantime, listeners can read more about the Suburban Garden by reading the book we've been discussing, titled Behind the Privet Hedge, Richard Sudell, The Suburban Garden and the Beautification of Britain, just out from Reaction. Michael, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you, Miranda.